for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2024, and you're listening to episode 392, which is a very big spoiler-filled conversation about the film Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. If you do not want to hear major surprises revealed in this episode, you'll want to see the movie and then come back and listen to it later. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online exclusive feature film review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes and the Mythologizing of Evolutionary Humanism. You can read the review for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
Today, as I mentioned, we're talking about the reboot of the Planet of the Apes film series. And the latest installment is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. And as we're recording this podcast, it was just released this weekend and it's on track to perform very well at the box office, specifically internationally. It's doing over 100 million so far in the first weekend if they include the international ticket sales. And so people might or might not be familiar with this series. It goes back more than 50 years. It's based on a book, originally a novel, by a French writer, and the very first film came out in 1968. So it's been a very long time, and there's been reiterations. Now, the last trilogy, full of CGI, and maybe some people remembered Andy Serkis's performance as a main character called Caesar, who we'll talk about, was concluded in 2017. And this series, this particular movie that we're going to talk about today, picks up on that. So, Cole, can you give us an overview of the Planet of the Apes series? What is it about? And, you know, what were the various different incarnations of it in terms of television and film?
Sure. So the series began with a French author by the name of Pierre Boulle. He wrote a novel in 1963 that was released in English in the United States as Planet of the Apes. I think in the UK it was released as Monkey Planet or something like that. Boulle, just for the sake of, you know, establishing his pedigree, is the same guy who wrote The Bridge on the River Kwai, the novel that the film The Bridge Over the River Kwai was eventually based on. So he has like this history of writing novels for these award-winning films. Story goes that Boulle was inspired to write the novel when he had visited a zoo and watched gorillas. He was supposedly inspired by how just human they seemed and their expressions and that kind of stuff. What maybe is sort of missed in all the noise surrounding the film series today is that the original novel was heavily influenced by like 19th century satirical fantasies. So like Gulliver's Travels was a huge inspiration for the original book. And so a lot of the sci-fi tropes and that kind of a thing was meant to be a satire in a lot of ways. And Boulle didn't even like the term science fiction for what he was writing, even though the film series is very much that now. He called it more of like a social fantasy or something like that. The novel, a little different from the movie itself. Obviously, it's following these, you know, this French journalist, and he's sort of recounting these events as he goes to this planet that's where these, you know, monkeys are. They're ruling. And so the book was actually taken to Arthur P. Jacobs. Jacobs was an American film producer who was known for his love of King Kong. He used to tell people he wished that King Kong hadn't been made so that he could turn around and make it. And Jacobs spent quite a bit of time trying to get the film actually made, but he eventually got it off the ground. And of course, it became the film that we all know, with Charlton Heston, and directed by Franklin Schaffner. So the film adaptation does its own sort of stuff with the material. And then, of course, the big reveal at the end is that the planet of the apes that they've been on is actually Earth, a kind of Earth of the future. So from the novel to the films and then the film series afterwards, the series has kind of evolved into what you could really call a cultural phenomenon. And it sort of holds up a mirror to humanity and human society through the lens of this world dominated by, let's say, intelligent apes. The original film was groundbreaking in its time for both the narrative and then the prosthetics that were used to create the characters. But both the film and the original novel portray this kind of role reversal, where apes are the dominant species and humans become quite primitive. The success of that first film led to a whole bunch of sequels in the 1970s, each sort of further explore and flesh out the future and then the past of this ape-dominated Earth. And so it creates this really sort of complex five-movie story arc that deals with, you know, societal evolution and stuff like that. So that's just a short overview of what the movies are all about.
Certainly the movies have come a long way since one of the reboots with Tim Burton. That was a little bit more on the campy side of things. So I would like to know just, you know, your article itself that I mentioned everyone can read on our website, equip.org. Your article discusses the series' connection to evolution and secular humanism. So can you unpack that a little bit and tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, and you can sort of pick this up just in concept alone, that the series has this kind of provocative edge to it for evolutionary ideas and secular humanism and stuff like that. So you have a world depicted where humans are not the apex species. And the way that it is science fiction is in the way that it takes the implications of Darwinian theory, but it takes it to a very speculative extreme. And so it challenges, let's say, the anthropocentric view of the world, right? This human-centric view of the world, and suggests that, you know, intelligence and moral capacity are not unique to humans. And, you know, these ideas are sort of tied in with secular humanism, particularly in how, you know, apes develop their own society, ethics, and morality independent of, you know, divine guidance, so to speak. So there's always, it seems that with this particular series, there is always a kind of undercurrent of evolution that is, you know, seeded throughout. Even this new film, I remember one of the trailers pretty heavily, you know, features this line that the villain says, which is, you know, are you familiar with the concept of evolution? And so it's just something that's always been there. I know, and I think I mentioned this in the article, that there was a location a few years ago, there was a screening of the film, the original film, hosted at a theater. But before the screening, there was a talk given by one of, you know, Harvard's professors of evolutionary biology. I mean, you just don't, there aren't that many films that at least I know of that have been hosted at a theater with a talk from, you know, a biologist given at the start of it. And of course, he's sort of picking apart the ideas and talking about how it's all just kind of fantasy and made up and what evolution actually looks like and all that kind of stuff. But you just don't find very many films with that kind of, you know, clout or drawing that kind of interest from the scientific community. So there has always sort of been this undercurrent of evolution and secular humanism throughout the films. But in a lot of ways, the films are satirizing some of that. And then I think with this reboot trilogy specifically, a lot of those initial ideas have been challenged, maybe even in ways that people don't necessarily recognize, taken at face value. But as the series, and we'll talk about this more, but as the series sort of moves further and further into this realm of mythic storytelling, as it moves further and further into incorporating things like the hero's journey arcs, which obviously you have for Caesar, which obviously you have for Noah in the new film, it sort of inches toward almost a kind of, you know, refutation of some of these ideas, which I think is interesting. It's a series that is it's growing. It's got the clout and the zeitgeist that it can try new things. It can flex its new muscles of and I think that's interesting, because clearly there's a plan to keep going with these. So I'm interested to see where these films end up.
We hope you've been enjoying the new setup of the Christian Research Journal, because it's completely without a subscription, totally free online, no paywall at all at our website, equip.org. But we would like you to consider partnering with us to continue to bring you all these free articles, a new one every single week, and also the podcast. So if you'd like to partner with us, the best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. If you click on Journal, then click on Postmodern Realities Podcast. At any one of the landing pages for the podcast, you will find a link where you can partner with us by giving us a tip. So if you could please consider giving us something like $3, $5, $10, that helps us to bring you this great content, which is completely free, a new article every week, and a corresponding podcast discussion. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to our new podcast called Christian Research Journal Reads. We take some of the most popular articles that we've done, the ones that are most frequently accessed on our website, and give you an audio version for those. They would be great for your commute or as you work out to listen to the full audio articles. And we would invite you to subscribe to that podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And now back to my conversation with Cole Burgett about the film in theaters now, The Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. So you're just kind of talking about some of the various ideas that are in the series that you mentioned in your review. But I want to talk specifically now about this particular film, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. And what does it really talk about in terms of the broader series? And also, what is it about just as a contained film? And this film picks up after the death of that main character, Caesar, that I mentioned in the intro. And also, it's several hundred years later, well, generations, the film says. And this is still apes, it seems, are the dominant species running the planet. And that's where it opens up. So tell us a little bit about the plot of this film and where you see it fitting into the entire, you know, scope of the entire series going all the way back to 1968.
Sure. So the new film, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, is set to sort of explore the fallout a few hundred years on of the initial ape uprising. So again, sort of the great spoiler for that original film is that the planet that they're on is actually Earth, a future version of Earth. That's that sort of iconic shot with Charlton Heston and the Statue of Liberty. So it's that's sort of the big reveal. So the reboot trilogy that came out starting in 2011 and ran through 2017 with Andy Serkis portraying Caesar, that series is, as much as it's a reboot, and I've only ever heard it referred to as a reboot, but it is a prequel. So I guess they just play fast and loose with continuity, It's a prequel, but it just reimagines certain elements of that original film series. But it focused on that original ape uprising led by Caesar. This new film, which is set several hundred years after that, I guess it would be like a midquel, right? It's between the original film and then this reboot prequel trilogy, is focusing on how apes survive and how the humans who have also survived navigate the challenges of coexistence and build a society. So one of the major themes at work in this new film is how the apes are supposed to coexist alongside of humans. And it's made more interesting by the fact that the planet is now firmly in the control of the apes. This is not like the wars that were fought in the reboot trilogy. This is where humans are very much have the short end of the stick on this deal. And that's sort of where Freya Allen's character comes in as a very unique kind of shifty figure. You don't really know which side she's swinging toward. You know, she's definitely in this, you know, for herself, but then it's sort of figured out throughout the course of the film that there's, you know, she's not just doing this for herself. She's also doing this for humankind. There's more ideas there. So that's sort of what this movie's about. There's a lot of, I guess you could call them, socio-political dynamics at play in ape society. It examines how legacy, particularly Caesar's legacy, which we can talk about, Caesar's legacy and leadership and just really, in a sense, memory, historical memory, how they all play a role in shaping the future, if that makes sense. So the film continues the trend, if you will, of using this sort of speculative future setting to begin addressing real-world socio-political issues like governance, power struggles, cultural memory, all that kind of stuff. So it's sort of, I guess, what you'd call epic in scope, despite the weirdness of the subject matter. I've always thought that these films were profoundly weird. It's just, they're very strange. But, you know, especially the reboots, once, you know, Matt Reeves came along and did his two films, they became quite good. Even, you know, they became both, you know, well-regarded critically, which the first film was as well, but especially the reboot trilogy became very highly regarded critically. They made a lot of money at the box office. So there's a kind of a prestige now associated with the series that maybe wasn't necessarily there. Certainly wasn't there in the wake of the 2001 remake, which I have a distinct memory of seeing in theaters. I must have been 6, 7 years old or something like that. And I remember even as a kid thinking this is, you know, very odd. But that's kind of what's going on. So it's a sequel to the prequels, but a prequel to the original film itself.
You know, the multiverse idea did not exist back in the 1960s in popular culture, but I wonder just when Charlton Heston comes to this realization of where he is, if that's kind of, I don't know if that'll play in now that that's kind of where we are in terms of storytelling for films in the future with whatever happens. Who knows if they'll, you know, even start exploring that whole idea of he was an astronaut and crashed on this planet type of thing. And it is interesting to me that the humans kind of turn the corner in this particular film. And they're different than they have been portrayed in any part of the series previously. They just, like you said, the character, May, is that her name? She is kind of an enigma. She's different than how humans have been portrayed as really kind of clueless and not very intelligent because they had the virus.
Yeah, and I will say that the trailers have done quite a good job at keeping keeping her true intentions sort of obfuscated. Everything leading up to this, and even the pre-release clip that was played in certain theaters, played in IMAX theaters, if I recall, definitely make her out to sort of be this, you know, almost a damsel in distress who is in need of Noah's saving. And that's actually one of the things that I think is most effective about the film, I had a friend who's a filmmaker who saw it, and we were talking afterwards, and he said, you know, I thought the way they handled her character was extremely well done. There were some twists with that character that, you know, I just didn't see coming. And that's what we were kind of laughing about. Like it's hard to pull a good twist on us these days. We've seen, we've seen so many movies and stuff like that.
Well, because they tell us in the trailer what the twist is usually.
Yeah, exactly. And I think her role specifically was fascinating. It was in a way, you know, in a movie about, you know, these monkeys, in a way that the human was the most interesting character, simply because her alliance was continuously fluctuating to get her what she was after. And I especially like that scene at the end of the film. You know, it's a bit of a spoiler. But after she has, you know, more or less betrayed them and gotten what she went there for and given it to the humans, there's that really well done scene where she's having that conversation with Noah. And on the surface level, it's a very, you know, heartfelt scene. And then it sort of cuts to that shot where she's actually holding the gun behind her back. And you realize, oh, this is her feeling him out. This is her trying to figure out if he's going to be a problem and if she has to kill him right here to get him out of her way. And it's so well done, the way that her character is handled. And it definitely sets up an interesting dynamic between the humans and the apes going forward, and especially between her and Noah.
It's interesting. I saw some interviews with the actress and the director about this, and they were saying originally what she shot was she comes up and she's actually not holding the gun behind her back, but she's holding the gun at him to his back. He doesn't see that she's holding the gun. So it's a little bit more, they made it a little bit more nebulous. Like, is she afraid of him? Does she think she's going to kill him? So you kind of don't know. But that really was a shock when, you know, you weren't expecting that as the viewer at, you know, as you see the end of the film. But I want to go back just a little bit and talk about the reboot trilogy, because Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is, you know, continuity from that. And it's picking up where the last one ended that was released in 2017. And it also is its own new exploration, because the main character that we've been talking about in the reboot trilogy, Caesar, is long deceased. So let's talk about Caesar. And he kind of looms large to me in this particular film, almost as a mythic character. So why is he so important to this story of the new movie? And I do feel like, we're going to talk a little bit about it later, but I do feel like he's morphed into there now being a religion created around him. And maybe the average person, the average ape, rather, doesn't really know who he is, but he is kind of looming big as a theme within this particular film.
Yeah. When all the initial publicity stuff about this movie came out, I was sort of under the impression that this was firmly in, like, this is a new thing camp. You know, it has the distance from that reboot trilogy in terms of just narrative setting. It's, you know, I think it's like 300 years in the future, where you could completely tell the story that is told in this film without connecting it to the reboot trilogy at all. And it really wouldn't change the very traditional hero's journey that Noah goes on. But instead, the film opens with Caesar's funeral, which is interesting because literally the last shot of the last trilogy is Caesar's death. And so it opens with a very firm handshake with the reboot trilogy, which I'll be honest, I wasn't expecting. And then, like you said, Caesar really looms large in this story. So in hindsight, I don't know that the film could be fully appreciated if you haven't seen especially that reboot trilogy. And you know what? From a filmmaking perspective, it was probably wise to connect it so strongly to that reboot trilogy because that reboot trilogy was so successful. And if you're going to be doing a sequel that's technically set in the same continuity, you would want to acknowledge that in some way, shape, form, or fashion. And I think what's interesting there, and this really works for the film, because Noah has such a traditional hero's journey story arc. Having Caesar play such an important role was wise, simply because you're never going to get out from under his shadow, right? What Andy Serkis did with that character was highly publicized. Even if, you know, you've not seen the reboot trilogy, chances are when you see that character, you at least know that it is a Planet of the Apes character. It's not just a random monkey with war paint on. He has a very well-established pop cultural presence, if you will. And in this new film, Caesar sort of emerges as this symbol, this mythic, quasi, you know, religious figure almost. And it's really sort of interesting. In the reboot trilogy, the character of Caesar, who was actually a character from the sequels of the original film back in the day, who was sort of reimagined and repackaged for this reboot trilogy. It's Caesar's development of human-like intelligence because of this, you know, genetic manipulation that's going on. He develops these human-like emotions and you know, intelligence that sort of sparks off the ape uprising. So over the course of the trilogy, he evolves from a very sort of curious and even compassionate or naive individual into a military leader who is very driven by this vision of coexistence with humans. That you know, even though, you know, he's seen the worst that humanity can offer, he's also seen the best, and he, you know, fully believes that they have to find a way to live together on this planet. But that ultimately is going to clash with the interests of the humans in Matt Reeves' films. And this leads to this sort of tragic character arc that Caesar has, where he genuinely seems to be fighting for some kind of peace between apes and humans, and something always comes along to disrupt that. So he becomes a kind of, even in the context of the reboot trilogy, Caesar becomes a kind of Moses figure, or even a Christ type, who is leading the apes out from under the oppressive humans into a better tomorrow, and then also trying to find a way to manage, to deal with the humans opposing them. And ultimately, in the end, it sort of takes him to his death. He sacrifices everything to save the apes. And this film picks up on the mythic threads of that reboot trilogy and turns Caesar into a literal mythic figure, even in the context of the story. This is such an interesting thing that you can tell a lot of thought went into this, right? What do we do with Caesar? And so his ideas, his legacy, really becomes the thing that governs ape society in different ways. So there are clearly these different factions of ape society. You have the village that Noah is a part of. You have the group that's almost like a group of monks that Raka is a part of, that study Caesar's philosophy, if you will. And then, of course, you have, you know, Proxima Caesar, who sort of, you know, looks at the military aspect of what Caesar did and sort of adopts all that. He pulls in the Roman influences. He's a very intelligent, very smart ape who basically employs, kidnaps, however you want to. It's not really made clear like what the relationship with William H. Macy's character is, but he's basically got him there just reading to him. You know, he's there just accumulating all of this knowledge, and he's fascinated by Roman history, and he takes the name of Caesar and sort of uses it to motivate the apes that he conquers to get on board with what he's doing. So it's this very fascinating exploration of the reboot trilogy's Caesar's legacy, and how his ideas are diffused throughout ape culture 300 years later, and how it also is nuanced, how it has changed, how those ideas are even in a lot of ways taken out of context, especially by the villain of the film. So Caesar, you're absolutely right, plays a huge role in this film, especially from an ideological standpoint, from a conflict standpoint, in ways that I certainly wasn't expecting. But it's also probably the smart way to play it, because you're never going to get out from under the shadow of that character, at least not so soon after the reboot trilogy.
You know, William H. Macy's character left me with a lot of questions. His character doesn't make it, but it's, you know, said, because there's mostly feral humans that are out there that can't really speak because of the virus, and who knows where they are. You know, we're talking, the film says many generations. I think the director says in other places 300 years, but, you know, many generations. I don't know how long is that. And he said, well, we leave it up to the interpretation of the viewer. But William H. Macy's character is not a feral human being. He's somebody who is well-read, and there he is trying to, as a matter of preservation, help this particular ape who goes by the name of Proxima Caesar. So you were just talking about, you know, Caesar and his place in this film, and he, you know, his legacy is a major issue for all of these apes, and that connects to, you know, I think modernist ideas that religion should die out, because it's really interesting, I think, how they portray religion. I'd like to know your thoughts about it, because it seems to me it's a very humanist take on religion. If people were saying, well, do we really know that Jesus said these things? We're 2,000 years out from these events. Here are these like tales people tell that they're trying to still influence people, that these are tales that Jesus said or Muhammad said or the Buddha said or whatever people think about religion. And so it has that tinge to it. And yet, at the same time, Caesar has become mythic, that you said, almost like a Christ-like figure. And in one sense, there are people that know about Caesar, like this Proxima Caesar, who's using that name to kind of conquer the world. And at the same time, there's people who don't know anything, like this kind of very nature-like tribe that the main character Noah belongs to. They're falconers. They raise eagles. And when he meets the, I don't remember the name of the ape that's in the woods that kind of, he falls through his trap. He's kind of like a monk, and he has been studying Caesar's works all these hundreds of years later. You know, it's so different than how you see Proxima Caesar saying what Caesar had to say. So it's become this religion of various interpretations. So what's exactly going on? And what do you think that the film is saying about religion? Because I feel like it's saying religion is not sufficient. Because, you know, what about the people who are doing good things like Noah and his tribe? They didn't know anything about Caesar.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting take on religion, especially in a series that has its roots in such secular modernist ideas. I'll take it in two parts. On the first level, I'll say that this development in the narrative, that even in a society that may reject traditional religious structures, the need for communal beliefs and revered figures can lead to the formation of new, even secular religions. If you trace the, you know, thread of modernistic thought, or at least modernist thought about religions, you would 9 times out of 10 come to the conclusion that religions are a thing of the past that should die out, because rationalism and scientific progress and all of these things are supposed to, religion is supposed to give way to them, you know, and belief in the supernatural is supposed to give way to something else. So while I grant that this is, and, you know, again, based on the subject matter and everything else, these films will always maintain that sort of secular modernist idea of religion. I nevertheless think it's immensely fascinating that the series is now dealing with a kind of, you know, pseudo quasi, whichever, you know, word you want to throw in there for what it is they believe. But it's almost like a quasi ape religion that is cropping up around Caesar. And it fascinates me because this stands pretty much in line with what scholarship has sort of started figuring out in the past, 10, 15 years of the first quarter of the 21st century, which is that you can't actually completely cut out religion from the public sphere. You actually can't get rid of it. It's not going to go anywhere. It seems like, again, communal beliefs, revered figures, all that type of stuff. It is just part of the warp and woof of human society. And this is, you know, reinforced with by history and all that kind of stuff. You know what? It's that old idea that you'll sometimes hear in you know, Christian schools, which is that, you know, there's not a culture that begins atheistic or something like that. All of that factors into the storytelling here. That being said, and this is the second level to it, what is the story's bend towards these religious ideas? Well, on one level, you know, it points to the need for an authoritative text. Caesar should have written something down, because now what you're starting to see in the movie story is this fragmenting of religion. Everyone sort of emphasizes a different aspect of Caesar's teachings. But I will also say that the film does not see Proxima Caesar as being right. It certainly emphasizes what Rocca teaches Noah. Rocca's the monk orangutan who has the history with Caesar. It certainly emphasizes what Rocca teaches Noah about Caesar and Caesar's ideas toward coexistence with humans that tie in. And, you know, I'll say this, it's not that Noah's people did not know about Caesar. You have that whole, you know, exchange between he and Rocca, where Noah sort of really comes to believe that the knowledge of Caesar and the knowledge of what humans actually were, and how humans used to be the dominant species on the planet, all of that was kept from him. He sort of reskins the village elders, I think he calls them, or something like that, that he grew up around, as having sort of worked to hide the truth from he and his people, and coming to this knowledge of Caesar and seeing humans for what they actually are and understanding where the apes are quote unquote, you know, wrong.
I don't think he knew who Caesar was by name.
No,
he didn't. Talk about, well, the things that you're telling me that Caesar taught, that's something that I was taught myself without that name.
Yeah, without the name. And coming to a recognition of Caesar, it's almost like a you know, in the context of a secular humanist take on religious ideas, it's almost like a coming to salvation for Noah. And that leads to his, you know, his great moment in the movie where he sort of puts two and two together and comes to the conclusion that the law is wrong.
It seems a little bit to me like, you know, who, when you encounter writings, essays by atheists that say, we don't need Christianity to be moral. We can be moral without God. It was kind of like that. Well, we have this morality in our particular tribe. We just didn't call it by Caesar. At the beginning, he talks about the law, and they were saying, oh, well, you don't need to go there. What they're doing is they're gathering these eagle eggs so that they can hatch and care for the eggs and hatch and then bond to these eagles because they're these falconer tribe. And so he's there with his friends, and they're supposed to have this like initiation ceremony into their adulthood. And they see a nest with three eggs, except for Noah says, no, we cannot take all of the eggs because that's the law. We have to leave one. So I think he references that later. You know, there's laws that we grew up with. We just don't call them that Caesar made them.
Yeah. And that's, I think, you know, part of the tension that this film is maybe not dealing with overtly, but is there, is that it is this very secular humanist thing, because that's baked into the warp and woof of the whole venture. And yet it relies on mythic tropes and religious ideas. So even though they have this law, that kind of stuff, that's sort of the revelation that Noah has in the movie, is that pretty much everything he's been taught is a result of Caesar's initial doing. Caesar's morality as the first ape, right? You see this in the reboot trilogy, the first ape to stand up and say no is Caesar. I think that's even talked about in the first film or the original trilogy. The first word that apes ever spoke to their humans was no. And you actually see that in the reboot trilogy. So Caesar's ethics, his morals, his ideas, whether or not they know him by name, is the thing that has influenced them to a large degree. And then, of course, you know, once Noah encounters Caesar's teachings under Raqqa, he begins to think through the things that don't fit within that. And again, that leads to his moment kind of at the climax of the movie-ish. I guess it's the climax for his character, where he literally sits and almost does like a, you know, if, you know, A plus, you know, B equals C, and A equals this, and B equals this, and A plus B equals C. And he comes to the conclusion that the law is wrong. And so now he's going to do something about it. He's actually going to, you know, get the apes out from under the oppression of Proxima Caesar, that it's not actually right to be militaristic, and it's not actually right to oppress the humans. He sort of, you know, he buys into Caesar's idea. And yeah, I mean, you certainly have that thread there that you can run down, where at the beginning of the story, he's in his village, he's doing his thing. They have their own set of laws. You know, you could parallel that, I guess, if you're wanting to, with the idea that, you know, you can have a culture that isn't necessarily Christian, but still follows a kind of baseline morality that is there. So it's certainly playing with that idea at the outset. But yeah, then again, of course, throughout the course of the narrative, Noah sort of comes to the conclusion that, you know, I've not been taught the full picture, and not everything I've been taught is completely right. And Caesar certainly has this, Caesar's ideas diffused to him by Raqqa are, you know, going to eventually clash with these different ideologies. And that's where the conflict goes in setting him up to go against, you know, Proxima Caesar.
I want to talk about that new character in this film. It's a villain named Proxima Caesar. We've been alluding to him throughout this conversation, played by the actor Kevin Durand. And he has a very different interpretation on what Caesar's ideals were, his teachings were, and the place of what humans should be in terms of their society, and also just how he has taken and twisted some of the teachings of Caesar. And that really makes me want to ask about, is that what people who are humanists would say? They would say, well, that's what religion is like. You know, it might start with a teacher, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, whatever they would say. But then there's going to be different interpretations that over the years, over 1,000 years, it's going to diverge from the original teachings of the actual person that the religion, you know, is supposedly started by. And so what part of this larger debate about religion and its place in society does he represent? Is he kind of like, oh, we're going out like the Crusades and we're just taking over all these different people to just implant this religion, which I'm going to be the new head of because I want to have all this power? So how is he representing religion in a different way in this film?
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like Dune, doesn't it? the ideas at play. But yes, I mean, I think what you've just said is it. Proximus Caesar, and he's very highly publicized, right? He's on all the, all the big cardboard cutouts. Him and his throne is all over the IMAX theater I was in and stuff like that. And he's sort of embodies this really radical departure from Caesar's ideas. He challenges the foundational beliefs established by Caesar and the apes of those older generations. And he advocates for this far more aggressive, and I think you could even get away with saying xenophobic, stance towards humans. His ideology represents this faction within ape society that sees coexistence as a weakness, really, rather than a strength. You know, and there's a great irony there with his character, which is that, but he can't read, so he has to have a human that he's, you know, kind of buddies with, so long as they know their place. He has to have this human named Trevathan, played by William H. Macy, to read him things, to give him the knowledge that he now uses to build this xenophobic empire. It's really kind of hilarious in that way. But his character brings into focus the tension between progressive and then like conservative forces within any society. And it explores how these different interpretations of legacy and history can actually diverge really dramatically and then lead to conflict on the backside. So he's this very charismatic. He arguably just, you know, the whole sequence at the dinner table, he's in a sense more charismatic than Caesar. He's a very intelligent, very charismatic ape, but he is very clearly drunk with power. And he is obsessed with gaining more knowledge. In fact, one of the things I think is interesting is this theme of forbidden knowledge that has run throughout the whole thing, especially since the reboot trilogy began. They basically what they're talking about, the thing that he's trying to get, is like guns and computers and all of this human technology that, you know, is, they say, allowed humans to, you know, communicate across the oceans and do all of these great things back in the day before, you know, the apes wiped out the world. And he's trying to get inside of this bunker. And he talks about all this knowledge and this information that's inside. And it's almost treated by him as this, you know, almost like a sanctuary, an area of sacred space. And when you get inside, you realize, oh, it's tanks, it's guns, it's weapons, it's computers, it's satellites, it's stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a satellite bunker thing.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to see how this character has taken a facet of Caesar's teachings and then sort of twisted it to meet his own ends, which is to justify his own rise to power. And in taking the title of Caesar for himself, because that's one of the curveballs that the film throws, is when Noah first encounters his cronies, you know, they're slaughtering other apes in Caesar's name. And, you know, if you've watched the reboot trilogy, you're like, well, isn't like Caesar's big thing that apes don't harm other apes? Like, what's going on? And then you realize, oh, they're not talking about the Caesar we all know and love. They're talking about Proximus Caesar, who has taken Caesar's name for himself. And it brings with it that mystique, that, again, that quasi-religious thing that elevates Proximus Caesar to almost be a kind of deity, even though he's this sort of, you know, despot emperor. So he's certainly an interesting villain. It's a shockingly philosophical turn for a film series about, you know, monkeys taking over the planet. But it certainly makes the central conflict of the film, as much as it is about Noah getting his family, it certainly makes the central conflict of the film far more about the ideologies at play than anything else. And, you know, it paid off. I mean, it's doing well at the box office. It's gotten, you know, solid critical reviews, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right in your analysis of the way that a secular humanist or a secular modernist even would read this, which is that, well, this is what religion does. It fragments, it splinters, it changes. I think Frank Herbert would love where this is going, which I think I even say in the article I wrote, that this really points to the need for a central authoritative text, which even then I understand can be, you know, misinterpreted and taken out of context and things like that. But at least there is a context to abide by and a context to hold to that you can use as sort of the guardrails of interpretation there. So, you know, who knows, maybe the next film will give us Caesar's secret Bible something like that.
Friends enter into a conversation with friends who've seen this, because they'll say, well, this is exactly what I think Christianity is like. You know, Jesus dies 2,000 years ago. There's all these denominations and splintering and different interpretations. And so what you have is similar to what I'm seeing here in Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. How can they really, you know, use this to have a more significant conversation about the truth of Christianity versus people who are self-styled messiahs?
Yeah, well, it's a fair point. But I would also say, well, consider the fact that we actually, like, and to put it in the context of the film's narrative, say, well, okay, let's say that Caesar's friends, right, the apes that he gets out of all of that with at the end of the War of the Planet of the Apes, let's say that before Caesar dies, they all sit down and agree to write Caesar's teachings. Let's say that they agree to write everything that they think future generations should know about ape society and laws and how things are to be. If Raqqa or Noah had that text, they wouldn't have to work so hard to show everybody else that what Proxima Caesar is doing is wrong even by Caesar standards. And therein really does lie the key difference. We have that. So it is actually a bit of a misnomer to suggest that, well, here's kind of what happened, this, you know, Jesus figure. And you can see the same thing with Muhammad or any Joseph Smith or any of these other, you know, religious, you know, factions. But the basic idea from a Christian standpoint is this. You could say, well, you know, Jesus shows up, he teaches some things, his teachings get confused, handed down generation after generation, nobody knows what he actually taught, except for the fact that we have a Bible. It is the most attested to ancient book in the world. It is extremely well preserved, and not even atheists are going to debate that one anymore, thanks to the discoveries of manuscripts well beyond even the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's just extremely well attested to. So as far as the teachings being passed on, turns out it's pretty accurate. Now, you can debate the interpretation all day long, which is what people do, right? This was sort of my big revelation in seminary, which was that, oh, you know, it's not so much the doctrine that's debated anymore. It's the hermeneutic. It's the way that people read the text that lead them to the doctrines that they hold to. That therein lies the fight, if you will. And so having not only a hermeneutic that accounts for the historical context, that accounts for the original letters and the original intent of the authors, but then having a hermeneutic that is consistent throughout the whole thing, that you can go from Genesis, Revelation, and apply and make every word on every page make sense contextually, that's huge. And that's a difference maker. So, you know, I think you're right. You see this all the time, this idea that, oh, well, it's just sort of, you know, diffused down through the ages. Well, that's not entirely accurate, because there is a text, and it is a very well attested to text. And that text really hasn't changed anything. The core 66 are extremely well attested to, and again, not even atheists seem to debate that anymore. I think it's interesting to me that even after the whole, you know, search for the historical Jesus at the end of the 20th century, very few people are going to stand up today and argue that Jesus of Nazareth did not exist. At one point in time, that was a very sexy thing to argue, right? Oh, I don't even know he was even there. You know, he was just made up. Well, even now, even today, very few people are going to argue that the guy didn't exist. The question is, what do we do with him? And that's where having something like Scripture, which is full of eyewitness accounts, that makes the difference. And even then, the writers of Scripture put such a great emphasis on the fact that they were eyewitnesses. I mean, look at how John opens not just his gospel, but opens his epistles, his later letters, right? What we have seen and touched and heard with our ears, what we have seen with our own eyes, you know, concerning the word of life, you know, we now tell to you, that type stuff. I mean, he puts such a great emphasis on the actual seeing, the actual, you know, touching, the actual walking with of Jesus. And I would, you know, to keep the story going, you know, it would be different if, you know, Rocca whipped out a Caesar's Bible that was written by the apes who were like, hey, we walked with the guy and we talked with the guy and this is how he interacted with people and this is what he said. That would paint a very different picture than what Proximus is teaching. So you're right. This is how it would be seen, but that's also just not true to history. And it's not certainly not true with what we have of Scripture. So that's how I would kind of approach that particular conversation, which I think is one that's worth having.
Well, I am not necessarily a Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes fan, but I would say it was an unexpected movie. I thought it was well done. And so that's something that people can put on their list. And there's a lot of food for thought to talk about with friends who are not Christians who see this film. Well, finally, I have a fun rapid fire question for Cole. We are ramping up all of our film reviews now that the Hollywood strikes are over. And so there's a lot of films coming out this summer. Of course, we've got the next installments of franchises we're going to cover on this podcast, including Mad Max and Aliens, and a new film from a longtime kind of spooky horror adjacent director, M. Night Shyamalan. But is there any particular film that you're looking forward to this most this summer? It could be something silly or serious, or just are you looking forward to some of these franchise installments or something different altogether?
It's a good question. I don't really know too much of what's coming out. I have been waiting for the Mad Max sequel. I was expecting more Mad Max, but that one I will see because I do like George Miller's work. But then I'm also pretty fascinated by the new Kevin Costner Western Horizon. I'm sort of thinking that'll be his version of, you know, his take on the Lonesome Dove epic story formula. So I'm looking forward to those.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 392 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written an online film review article for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called The Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes and the Mythologizing of Evolutionary Humanism. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.